Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are trying to hold it together after the collapse of the Key Bridge over my neighborhood. We are going to be putting together the Maryland Crab Cake Tour for the first time in a long time since we did Cup of Super Bowl back in February with our friends from the Maryland Lottery. We're going to be at Costas next Tuesday, the 9th of April, before the Orioles-Red Sox 2 o'clock game. We'll be there all morning into the afternoon. I don't know what we're doing in regard to relief and conversation and dredging the bridge and getting a new bridge, but our friends over in the peninsula are a little trapped right now and want to make sure we give them some love. We'll be there on Tuesday. Friday, we'll be at Fadley's downtown in the new Lexington Market. All new location. Luke's going to be there. We're going to be live from 2 until 5. That is on the 12th. And again, on the 26th, it's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. It's been a little while since I've had this guy on. I almost bothered him in late January into early February when the word came that the Orioles would be sold. He covers the business of a lot of things, but I know him as a long time baseball writer. My dad bought the Baseball Digest when Barry Bloom's name was in it a million years ago. I was Kid Howard Balzer about that with Football Digest as well, and the Associated Press and headlines and newspapers and all of this stuff. All these years later, he's become my friend and also a cancer survivor and a guy who documents one of my favorite teams, the McDonald's mustard and brown of the San Diego Padres of my Aunt Jane of the mid-1980s. He is currently working for Sportico, covering baseball and all sorts of things, Final Four, Phoenix, and he's into the Coyotes and has moved out to the Phoenix area from his original hometown back here in the East Coast. Welcome, Boomski, Barry Bloom, longtime Associated Press now at the Sportico. What's going on? We have new ownership, Barry. I was going to reach you in the early excitement, but I'm like, you know, Let the contract get dry, let the money get into the Angelos account, and then I'm going to talk to you about the future of the Baltimore Orioles.
Well, thank you, Nestor. I mean, I'm going to have to hire you to do all my introductions. That was fabulous. You know, I think what's great about it is that the Angelos has left them with a pretty darn good base. They've got a great young team, and now, as you saw with the addition of Corbin Burnes, who had a great start to start the season. I mean, now with an influx of money, you know, this team has a chance to be one of the powerhouses of the AL East at a time when some of those teams are down. I mean, to me, Tampa, Toronto, and Boston are not quite caliber. They may be playoff teams, but they're not going to win the division. The Yankees kind of surprised me this weekend, sweeping the Astros, which they never do. But I guess the worm was going to turn with that eventually after all these years, because the Astros have dominated them for a while. But I'm excited about just saying that, you know, the Orioles are really the team to beat in the AL East right now.
Barry, you cover the business of sports better than anybody. I mean, strikes and going back to Lords of the Realm now 30 years ago and understanding the dynamics of ownership and understanding just how incompetent at times the Major League Baseball people can be, right? I was nationally syndicated back at the turn of the century, and it was contraction. And we were going to lose Montreal. We were going to lose Minnesota. Like, these things were – none of that happened. It greatly, greatly affected – my franchise, Peter Angelos and Masson and the Washington Nationals. And now they've got this eyesore with the Oakland franchise. I was down in Tampa for spring training this time last week, and just it never came. That blimp sits there at the end of St. Petersburg. They've been trying to fix that for a long time. But this Orioles situation, they let this thing atrophy. Peter and his kids just making money and money and more money. They got $1.7 billion to cash out last week, and the team never turned. The only time it's turned now is because they were so bad for so long, and they had so many high draft picks. And John hired a genius in Mike Elias to come in here and bring in great baseball players. Now, we had the Jackson Holliday debate on the field. We'll talk about Rutschman and Henderson and what Corbin Burnes represents, and even Grayson Rodriguez now, what he could represent, which was the original hope before they bought Burnes. Somebody has to pay these players, right? And in this market where tickets are $9 tonight and it's raining and it's cold and the Royals are in town and nobody's going, I'm trying to figure out from a revenue standpoint, and look, man, you were there when attendance mattered. Back when I was a boy and I would read your work in the late 70s, early 80s, it was always attendance. Philly had it. The Dodgers had it. The Yankees had it. The Angels had it. They had our players. They got all of our players back in the day. And I had to learn tier A and B and one and two, free agency and Charlie Finley and George Steinbrenner. I came into journalism in 1984 losing my football team because we didn't have money, 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 right? And I keep thinking about these players in this core and where it is right now. And Rubenstein bought this team and where they are and where the revenue is. And it's been really, really poorly run for so long that I don't even know where to track it back to when it really got awful. But from a revenue standpoint, they're going to need to make money here to pay the best players. I keep going back to that. Like, you don't want to settle for being, we're Tampa and we draw 12,000 fans and that's what we are. I think that the Baltimore Orioles can be more than that, Barry. And I know you've seen them be a whole lot more than that.
Well, that's a whole lot to cut into there, Nestor. But I look at where baseball is right now on the regional sports network problem, and that's really an outgrowth of all the things that you just mentioned. You know, you go back to the mid or early 60s when Pete Rozelle went to the NFL owners and he said, look, we're better off if we nationalize our television package and we'll evenly split that money among all the teams. You know, obviously there was a lot less teams back then, but he knew that having been a Los Angeles Rams PR guy, that the big markets like Los Angeles and New York were just going to grow and they were going to outgrow the Green Bays and a lot of, you know, the Baltimores and a lot of other places in the country. So they nationalized it. They evenly split the money and it turned out to be the bottom line growth project for the NFL, where every year their salary cap is pretty much met by their national television money. And then everything else is an expenditure. So now you have baseball, which is the only major non-salary cap league because of how the owners have been able to kowtow to the union over the course of the years. And, you know, you're in a situation where if in the 1960s, Major League Baseball had the foresight to go to the 16 owners at the time before even expansion, and said, we're going to buy your television market, your local television market, and give you a million or two each, it would have cost like $32 million. And then we're going to take it over. We're going to run your local television market. And then that money is going to be evenly split among the 16 teams. You would not be in this position you're in right now.
Sort of an original sin in the Garden of Eden, right? It's sort of it's Messersmith, right? From 73 on.
No, it has nothing to do with Messersmith. This is just the free agent system. Every sport dealt with how they were going to come to a compromise with their unions and their players on the free agent system. This is purely the money you're talking about that needs to be generated for teams like the Orioles to make more money to be able to substantiate buying more players. And you have a lopsided television market now where teams like, and there are probably nine of them because I've been looking very closely at this, you have teams like, and I'll just give you Yankees, Dodgers, Mets, Cubs, Giants, even the A's have got a huge television contract which they don't want to give up before they go to Las Vegas. And they're going to lose when they go to Las Vegas. But the point of the matter is you have a messy Masson situation, which was created by Angelos with Bud for him to agree to move the Expos to Washington. And instead of a 50-50 split with both teams on that money, Baltimore took over that RSN, and it's been a mess and in court ever since. So they're one of the have-not teams in terms of the amount of money they have, and Angelos was an old-time owner who didn't have those kind of deep pockets that Rubenstein and Lerner and all the people coming into MLB now have. Anybody who's going to buy into a professional sports franchise in the big four leagues, to me, and I don't include soccer in this at this point, they have to have billion-dollar pockets to be able to grow and compete in those leagues. So now you have a chance. But the problem is, and this is going to be a fight, because I've been talking to people about it, there's going to be a fight on revenue sharing these RSNs that are left, like YES Network and SNY and what the Dodgers have going on. And those big market teams are not going to want a revenue share. And you have 75% of the owners that have to vote on this for it to happen. And the perfect example for you is that when they nationalized the internet and created MLB.com, each individual team owned their own internet site, much like the RSNs. But there was a vote to create MLB.com and eventually the MLB Network. And that vote, there wasn't enough big market teams to block it. There were too many small market teams that just wanted to revenue share it and say the Yankees have a bigger market, their network is going to be worth more, or their internet's going to be worth more. We're going to want them to revenue share evenly with the league. And it's been the best thing that baseball has ever done. Now they need to figure out a way to do it with the RSNs to give everybody an even playing field so they can negotiate every year. And then you take a look at what's gone on and the fight with the union recently, which Tony Clark seems to have survived, and Bruce Meyer seems to have survived. But a lot of it is that big market teams like the Yankees and Mets didn't go out and spend this year. Dodgers did. Out in my area in the NL West, it's now created the strongest division in baseball because Major League Baseball spent $2.9 billion on free agents this year, and the Dodgers, the Giants, and the Diamondbacks spent $1.6 billion of that. And you have two of those teams with great RSNs in the Giants and Dodgers and the Diamondbacks that lost their RSN and are trying to build a new network and parlay off their National League championship. And this is where attendance does mean something. If you don't have any place to go where your money has dissolved on your local television dollars, then you have to build up your attendance and put seats in the ballpark to spend money, and people spend money on concessions and merchandise and parking and all those ancillary items, which can bring up your revenue, which is starting to happen for the Diamondbacks. So it's a long, complicated answer, to your multi-pronged question.
Barry Bloom is here. I mentioned the Messersmith thing because I mentioned free agency and I mentioned how Habs had no problem with free agency. The Yankees ate that up because they had the money. And I think the original sin is really the owners fighting with the owners. It was always rich owners versus poor owners. That's what all the Players Association, all the union people would be telling you all of these years, is that they never could organize that. As Art Modell once said, a room full of Republicans that act like was a liberal to vote socialist or whatever his phrasing was on the politics of that with Pete Rozelle. That's been a missing ingredient in baseball. And Steve Bisciotti once said to me, it's the reason he didn't want to buy a baseball team. He didn't think it was a fair system.
To your point, I remember one collective bargaining agreement in the early 2000s. I think it was 2002, where they were trying to figure out how to revenue share money among the haves and the have-nots so that money filtered down from the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Mets to the smaller market teams. And they basically went to the union in collective bargaining, and they said, we can't figure this out among the owners. Figure this out for us. And Don Fehr at the time said, that's not our job. But ultimately, in that collective bargaining agreement, they figured it out, and the revenue sharing system, among all of this, is money that is shared that's come out of that agreement from 2002 and 2003. The drug agreement came out of it. The revenue sharing model came out of it, and it was supposed to be, it was an anti-Yankee thing at the time, But now the Yankees, you know, they sit back and they do what they're going to do, you know, within their market and the amount of money they're going to make. And they're going to be successful revenue-wise, whether they win the World Series or they don't. Their ethos is, yeah, we'd like to win. And it's a disappointing season if we don't. But in essence, they're going to make $600 million a year in revenue, no matter whether they win or lose, because people are going to go to the stadium and watch that team play. And they win every year, at least. They've had 30 years in a row with a winning record. You know, they're not putting a bad team on the field in any year. So, yeah, that's exactly where it comes from. And if you go back to, you know, where start with Curt Flood and Marvin Miller and how the union broke the owners down, you know, at that time, you know, it was owner against owner and what they wanted to do. And, you know, Charlie Finley probably had the best idea when the Messersmith decision came down and McNally decisions came down and the reserve clause was, you know, term mute, you couldn't use it anymore. So that every player was a free agent. And Charlie Finley said, fine, let's flood the market. Everybody every year becomes a free agent. And Marvin Miller said, no, we don't want that. We don't want too many people out in the market. And he put the deal in place, which still exists today, where you have to be a 6-year free agent. Where the owners really lost it was they tried to put in the arbitration system before free agency, thinking it would put a stop on free agency. And that turned out to be the greatest bane in their system because they really don't have any control of that. That's an either or.
Well, that's what I said. There's a long history of sort of owner incompetence and failing up. I mean, I tried to express to Mr. Rubenstein's guy that Peter Angelos put $29 million of cash up in 1993 using money and collateral that Bob Castellini and Bill DeWitt later used to purchase the Reds and the Cardinals in this deal that Larry Lucchino was originally in and then got thrown out of and went to San Diego, as you will, and then the Boston, and you could document all of that. But, you know, as I pointed out, that $29 million became $1.7 billion for his kids, and all they did was wreck the franchise. They didn't do anything of any positive measure here in 30 years in regard to winning, investing, making things better in any way.
They were two small fry owners to be able to do it within the system the way it grew. They couldn't. It would be as if Charlie Finley or his, you know, heirs with that amount of money were still trying to compete with the big boys in the league.
Look, Mark Davis failed up right into the biggest deal in Vegas, right? Like, at some point you fail up. There was no saying he wouldn't wind up in Nashville with the franchise.
How many times did he, you know, he and his father moved the team from Oakland to L.A., back to Oakland, down to Vegas? How many years did that take? That was over a 30-year period of time in a league where you have a salary cap and a floor. There's not, you know, anything you can do about it. In baseball, you have no salary cap, you have no floor, and in some cases, there's no incentive for you to spend any more money if you know you're going to lose than $30 million a year on your payroll, even though the top team and the top echelon is paying like the Padres did. They were number three last year at 256, and they couldn't absorb that kind of money in that market. But they did it anyway because, you know, my long friend and cancer patient, you know, the late Peter Seidler, you know, wanted to buy a team that would win the World Series for the Padres before he died. And it was with the greatest of intentions, but he didn't make it. He passed away after numerous battles with Don Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, you know, and now you're left with a situation there where it's the same Padres with Mexico to the south, the Pacific to the west, the mountains to the east, and Camp Pendleton to the north. And they only have a limited market to sell that team to, and they've saturated the market. You know, all you can do now is raise concession prices and ticket prices to bring in more money. Plus, they lost their $60 million a year television contract too. So where do they go? They've cut $100 million off their payroll this year, but they still have an expensive central team for what he spent. And now they're going to have to make some decisions about their own ownership and where they're going to go. And so you can't complain about Angelo's buying a team for 29 million back in the day, and that the everybody the Orioles got taken along with valuations of MLB franchises, and they cashed out at 1.7. I mean, it's 1.7 billion. Every team is
which is
in
why
that.
The Players Association argues all the time they're making plenty of money.
Yeah,
all of them.
Scott Boras just said, I just quoted him in a story today. He said that they're going to make more money in the league this year than ever before, and nine teams have a lower payroll this year than they did last year. But that's their choice. You know, it's like,
imagine if they fixed Oakland. You know what I mean? Like, you know, they're doing that with this eyesore.
No, they can't fix Oakland. They can't fix Oakland because, you know, I covered that. I've been writing about it, and I laugh about it because I broke in San Francisco when Barb Lurie saved the team, and Horace Stoneham sold it to Labatt's, and it was supposed to move to Toronto. And the National League nixed it. Bob Lurie bought it and saved the team in 1976 and then started work on a new stadium for the Giants. And it took 25 years. You know, it's like I feel like my entire career, aside for the Padres, has been dictated by the Giants and the A's and what their machinations are in that Bay Area community to remain, outmaneuver each other. And the situation in Oakland is they were pretty close to that ballpark, building that ballpark at the Howard Station. Oakland had come up with the money because of the grant situation coming out of COVID. They were right there. And when it came time for Fisher to put the money in for that ballpark, he pulled the plug. So they did everything they possibly could. And if I were them, until you know what the future of the Coliseum is going to be, why would you even put a dime into it? They won't put a dime into it, and it's turned into a ghetto. You know, nobody, it's a bad team and a bad place to watch a game, and there's no reconciling it. And so
yet
I'm
they're
not
back
sure.
They're playing, and they've known this all along. They've had years.
Yeah, well,
reminds me of Montreal, where they just let it go and let it go and kick the can.
But they have a lease, and they've made, you know, proposals to Oakland and the Coliseum Commission to do some work, and they don't have any money in Oakland to do any work. They don't have any money for police. They don't have any money for schools. They don't have any money for the BART system. I mean, it's a decrepit, what's going on in San Francisco, and you read about nationally, is 10 times worse in Oakland. So how you're going to say we're going to squeeze money out of Oakland because we have multi-million dollar, billion dollar ownership, wants to keep a franchise there and build a ballpark. Yeah. I mean, it was and may still be, who knows, but it was a generational chance they had there in Oakland to build up the north side of that city. And it's never going to happen again. They're going to be the old decrepit city that they've always been. It would be, if you go back to 1990s, and Baltimore hadn't decided to help the Orioles with Lucchino and Edward Bennett Williams and those guys back then to build that ballpark at Camden Yards. I mean, that whole part of the city and the North Harbor, or the South Harbor there, would have never been developed. So, and that's where you are in Oakland. That whole, you know, square there, Jack London Square, which is the nicest part of Oakland on the water, would have been redeveloped all the way across there on a piece of property that's moribund.
I stayed there last year. I went to see Pearl Jam, and the A's were actually playing a game, you know, during the time that Pearl Jam was playing in the Coliseum in the adjacent parking lot. And I was in San Francisco about 8 weeks ago, 9 weeks ago. I mean, California, they're not giving teams $1.2 billion of public funding the way my state did for these two owners, the baseball owner and the football owner. I mean, the baseball owner here, Rubenstein, you know, inherits not just Camden Yards, not just the television network that serves the teams.
They never have. I mean, you know, Petco Park took 10 years and it and San Diego threw in, you know, half of the amount of money for it, mostly out of a hotel motel tax and a redevelopment tax. But, you know, that's the last one that's gotten any public contribution because the Kings basically, there was some money from Sacramento because they were saving the team, but most of that for that arena was built on its own. The Warriors were totally self-funded. The Giants were totally self-funded. Nobody in California is giving any money to owners to build stadiums and arenas, and especially with all the laws and hoops they have to go through. Really, I documented it. What the A's had to do to get through the state, local, and port with all the permits and stuff to get that close to build the Howard Terminal out, they spent years and millions of dollars on this. People who blame Fisher that he never really was serious about it, they're wrong. He spent a ton of money on it. And he just got to the point where post-COVID, post what everything happened that was going on in California in the Bay Area, where he just judged, I'm never going to push this over the top. And now all of a sudden you get the newspaper there, my friends at the San Francisco Chronicle, who didn't pay any attention to it until the A's announced they were going to Vegas. And then it became a fait accompli. And instead of the people in Sanford in Oakland going, we got to go out there and we got to buy as many tickets as we possibly can to keep this team here or try to keep this team here, their reaction was, well, no, screw Fisher. We're going to boycott and not spend any money. And so, I mean, look, did you see the attendance out there this
It's
weekend?
unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, 13,000 for opening day and like 5,000 to 3,000 the other three games. They've got the Red Sox this week. I don't know why the only reason why the A's would want to stay there is to maintain that $60 million they're getting in television money from Comcast in the Bay Area. Because if they move out now, they're going to lose that. And that's too big a chunk for them to basically weather over the course of the next 3 or 4 years, if and when they're ever going to get that stadium done in Vegas. So, I mean, it's a pipe dream to a certain extent. And Oakland has really no standing to tell baseball that, well, if the A's are going to leave, we want their colors, we want their name, we want a guarantee that you're going to give us an expansion team. Really, where and for what? Who's going to build? Who's going to fund it? I mean, they had the chance when the A's were sold, when Lacob of the Warriors wanted to buy it, and he would have had this done a long time ago. But Lacob is getting older. I'm not sure what his finances are. And for baseball, it's a $4 billion to $5 billion project to either move a team in, or if you want to add expansion fee, who's going to have that kind of money? And what municipality is going to pony up that kind of money for an MLB expansion team or a team to relocate? I mean, Vegas is throwing up 400 million. That's it. And it's limited to that project on at the Tropicana Hotel, right in the middle of the strip, where they will build on 9 acres, a very smallish ballpark with a dome on it, with a like half of a dome on it, because there's not enough land there for them to put up a stadium with a retractable dome. It needs a lot more than nine acres. It to give you a comparison, the Coyotes now are they're going to bid on a piece of land in North Phoenix, bordering on North Scottsdale, at the other end of the valley from where downtown is, and they're going to put it's a $2 billion project that they're paying for themselves, and it's 100 acres that they're building on for an arena and a surrounding complex, that will help pay for it with a training facility and hotels. And you've also reached
The
the part,
Atlanta baseball experience, but for hockey, kind of, sort of.
right? Exactly. And even with the Atlanta baseball experience, they got into it at the right time because post-COVID, nobody needs the office space anymore that were part of these projects to build. So now just take that all out of the equation. It's got to be, rental properties and purchase properties and entertainment and like they're building a practice facility and a theater, but it's 100 acres, like I'm saying there, and 9 acres for a baseball stadium in Las Vegas. That it just doesn't track.
Barry Bloom is here. He is Boomski. He is at Sportico. He is a longtime baseball business observer, as well as on the field and off field. I'm a half an hour into this with you, and I haven't even gotten to like the point, which was to bring you on and say you've seen a million of these things. We've talked about all these land developments and all this crap. This guy's got $600 million coming in here, this land that John Angelos basically tried to steal from the governor last year. You can look that up. All gone now. The Angelos thing's over with. I don't have to bitch about that anymore. What's your advice to David Rubenstein and him coming in here and taking this thing over in regard to how poorly the business has really been run here? And I've been on the front lines of that and Masson, and you can't get the Masson app anywhere and stream the games. All of that's a mess. The fight with the Nationals, all of that's bad. The team on the field's really good, and the baseball side's fixed, so we don't even need to talk about that other than a pitcher, a relief pitcher, this, that, what they're going to do with their money. But what's your advice to him, the $1.7 billion owner who's coming in, to find, as I told his communication specialist, a lot of trauma and a lot of terrorization of the community here in regard to Angelos and people staying away? And you know, I was here when we lost Mike Flanagan. I was here when he ran John Miller. I mean, I know the whole history and I lived it all. I'm 18 years without a press credential. What's your advice to him?
At this point, that's ancient history. There's nothing that can be done about it. And, you know, you have to move forward. So, I mean, there are only five teams under Rob Manfred's reign as commissioner that have been sold. Going back, and it, you know, actually four. There's been five teams since 2011. The Padres were one of them when John Moore sold to Seidler and his family in 2012. So that was right before the transition from Bud to Manfred. So you've had Miami, you've had Kansas City, you've had Baltimore,
Mets,
and the Mets. That's it. And two of them were basically the Kansas City, the previous Kansas City owner died. Angelos was in the process of his illness, and so two of them were because of illness. But you have had, because of the escalation of the amount of value each franchise has from top to bottom, you've had very few people in baseball who wanted to sell their teams. Regardless of all the things that we've talked about here previously in this segment, they don't want to give up their teams. So, I mean, so you look at, new team came in Miami, and if I'm Rubenstein, I look at what did the Padres do? How did they, you know, build a secure product out of nothing? You know, when Seidler bought the Padres, they had been close to getting into the playoffs in 2010, but they had not been in the playoffs since 2006. You don't have this with Rubenstein. The Orioles were in the playoffs. They got wiped out last year, but still, they've got a product there where they've already made the playoffs in a much expanded playoff system than when Seidler bought the Padres. So now, you know, you get forward. It took years for them. 2020, they made the playoffs with the expanded playoffs in the COVID season. Then, you know, 2 years ago, they made the playoffs and went to the NLCS. And even Miami made the playoffs last year with their cost cutting and everything they do. So essentially, you have to look at what did Tampa Bay do, you know, with Steinberg and all those guys, and what they've done with their baseball ops to basically produce a competitive team every year. They haven't won it all, but they've been to the World Series twice without spending a whole hell of a lot of money and divesting themselves practically of every player. Like Glasnow, for instance, going to the Dodgers. It's like when you have to pay them, they go on to a bigger team and they finish out their careers with making a lot more money and doing other things, but they have a line of players to replace these guys because that's the way they develop.
Well, that was the only way it was going to work with Angelos, right? If Angelos continued to own this team the next 5 years, it was not going to be because they were going to spend $180 million on payroll.
So now, essentially, as you point out, you have your general manager, which came out of the Astros system. He used the Lunau paradigm to build the Orioles. And now, you know, they're in a situation where all they have to do is basically spend a little money to, you know, accompany that to keep that team, you know, competitive. As we started out here, the AL East is not at its greatest moment of competitiveness, they have a chance to, in the expanded playoff system, to go to the playoffs every year. So that's what I would do. I would keep out of the baseball ops. You've got a good baseball op. Any owner or whoever gets involved because they say they know baseball, like Lucchino used to always say that, and he'd want to make decisions on baseball. And every time it did, whether it's with Orioles, Padres, Red Sox, it usually blew up in their face. And eventually he got fired in San Diego. And ultimately in Boston, they didn't want to have anything to do with them. And they just said, just stick to the business side. We don't want you tinkering in baseball. So the owners and lawyers are not the best baseball people. You hire baseball people to run your baseball organization and let them run it and make your recommendations. That's the best thing I could say for him. Just continue to build it up. You're not going to have the top draft picks anymore because you're winning, but you can build. A lot of teams do. I mean, Aaron Judge was a low draft pick. I mean, the Yankees haven't had draft picks for 30 years because they're always competitive, but yet they always come up with a wave of younger players who are, like Volpe and, people like that who, really, starring in the organization or are good pieces to trade. So that's my recommendation to him. Look at where the new owners and how they've adjusted to the marketplace with all the owners that have been around for a long time, and then let the baseball operations continue to do their job. And they've obviously been smart about it, and let it move forward and see what happens so they can be competitive. And then, and you can tell me this more than anything else. I haven't been to Baltimore for a couple of years, but my impression is that one side of the ballpark in that and the football stadium in that area is not the greatest neighborhood in the world. So basically, you have to cope with the fact that in Baltimore, a lot of people living near the ballpark can't afford to go to that ballpark. So you're going to have to figure out ways of merchandising and giveaways and lower price tickets. Like the Diamondbacks this year and the last couple of years, they've offered a $50. You can go to any general admission ticket. You can go to any game you want to for the rest of the season. Those are the kind of things you have to do. It's like you're selling seats that are empty. So it's like, how do you put fannies in those seats and make it affordable for people to go? So then they go to the ballpark and buy a hot dog and a pretzel and an Oriole cap. And that's the way you start to monetize it. But I'm guessing that he's going to have his smart people. He's going to bulk up the business side of that organization to start doing that. And you have a historic, beautiful ballpark to get fans to come into. And that's going to be a whole part of the system that starts with a good team on the field and a product to sell. And that's why the Diamondbacks are capitalizing on it right now. It's like, we've got the team. We're going to spend more money on it. We need to compensate for our television money by putting fannies in the seats and, building up our subscription base to the MLB streaming model. And so, they have to do the same thing. So that's my holistic recommendation to them. And I'm sure they're going to be smart and way ahead of me on it.
Baseball nerds like you and me and Luke, we're watching no matter what. We've watched all this awful baseball. I keep thinking to the fringes of people who like the Ravens but don't experience baseball or haven't experienced good baseball, or it doesn't come to them, or they don't have cable television, so they don't have it in their house every day, that there has to be an engagement point for you to care about players and engage with the players and want to get out and experience it. And I think in our community, for all of us who have been doing it since Boog and Brooks, and my last name's Aparicio, right? Or Callinetti, or even Brady Anderson, after that. And Mike Mussina. My kid loved Mike Mussina. He's 39 now. He hasn't been to an Oriole game in 10 years. You're not in the habit of going. They didn't give you any reason to go. Then you had a plague. Then you had bad baseball, like all of that. Now there's a sniff of, hey, something's going on down there.
Yeah,
When
plus
you go down there, it's got to taste good the first time. That's
you have
all.
to bring all those people back into the fold if they're not going, and make them part of the organization so that Cal's back in it. You have to see all these people, get them there for special events, have commemorative dates for, you know, the last time the Orioles won the World Series, you know, who's around. I mean, all those things, whether it's bringing back, you know, the 1966 team, the 1971 team, the 93 team. There's still, I'm sure, plenty of people around from the 93 team, which is the last time they won the World Series.
83. So, you meant 83, but that's okay.
83, right. Yeah, so it's like.
That's 10 more years, Barry, you know.
There's still 1983. There's still.
Okay. Well, you know what? There was such bad blood. Lowenstein would never come back because of the old man. Well, you know, like, there was a lot of that that went on that could be fixed.
To, like, go in and basically, you know, like, patch that those wounds.
Yeah.
And bring them all back into the fold to make a connection with the older generation of baseball fans, with the newer ones who are saying, you know, who are these guys? You know, but let's teach them about who they are and what they do.
I'm quoting you on this, Barry. Patch those wounds. I'm typing this as we speak here because I'm writing my letter right now to David Rubenstein. So patch those wounds. Ah, I love it. Thank you. This is why I get real writers on like you. You inspire me. Hey, listen, always a pleasure. And I know it's not the last time we'll get together. We'll talk some more baseball. I love that the team's relevant. I love that they can be welcoming. I love that Cal Ripken's involved in it. And I love that I might be talking to more people like you more often because, like, I love baseball, right? And when they're losing 120 games, there's not a whole lot of reason to call Barry and, like, hang out and geese about whether Andy Rettersmith was the beginning of all of this or not. But we'll do all that later on. But we're going to have pennant race talk about around here.
Right. Let me leave you with this, and I've been talking about this a lot lately. Even with the rule changes in baseball, most of the rule changes have done have restored baseball to where it was in a more coherent time when you had 2 hour and 20 minute games and you didn't have to sit at the ballpark because of analytics and the way that it's managed and you're winding up with a 4 hour game. But the point is, unlike every other sport that I've been watching since I was a kid, baseball is pretty much the same. It hasn't changed. You still throw the ball, you hit the ball, the field is the same. There might be a tinkering of rules of how you score a run or not, but mostly not. But if you look at basketball, hockey, and football, it's a completely different game than when I was a kid. The whole context of it is different. The NBA, they don't have centers anymore. The three-point line has changed it. You have different defensive, you know, things that are marked on the boxes. The players are different. It's still a fun game, but it's completely different. Hockey, completely different. I mean, when I was a kid, nobody wore helmets. There were no three-line passes. There was no no-touch icing. I mean, there were fights all the time. I mean, it's a completely different game. And the same thing with football, which they tinker with all the time. They take out the kickoff return, now they're trying to put it back in some fucked
way. A lot of
way.
Defenders would say they outlawed tackling last week, so I understand. I'm with you. Exactly. Barry, I love you, man. I know you got a role. You're doing Diamondbacks. You're doing hockey. I'll get to you in the desert. I do miss Cactus baseball. I love coming out there in March when it's nice and we don't have rainouts out there. So I will come and visit with you. Love visiting with you. Loved your insights and right on point as always. So keep up the good work out at Sportico.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Barry Bloom, he's going to do a book at some point on the San Diego Padres in the mid-80s, I swear, and I'll be the first guy in line to buy it with my mustard jersey on and my Tony Gwynn 19. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore positive.